Welcome to Are You Real, episode 56. Hey Roar Nation, John Fuller here, and I am excited for today's episode. But before we get started, I always promise that for those of you that take the time to jump into iTunes and read off and send me a review, I want to read it and say thank you. So this week is to Mentally Strong, and just want to read it real quick. It says, what a powerful podcast. John provides so much value to help us live in the image of God. Can't wait to listen to more. So whoever Mentally Strong is, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to get on here and to review us. And for those of you out there, please share the episode. Send it out to friends, family, whoever. And jump on there and get the information that my guests, some of these guests that we bring on today, like today, breed so much value. And I just want to share what they're doing with the world, how they're impacting and changing culture. So I'm excited about that. So if you guys go back to episode 7, I know some of you have sent me emails and said that you have listened to every episode. So you are going to be familiar with today's episode, previous from show 7, which we go back almost a year. Yesterday was a year. But I told you that we were going to bring this man back because he had so much value and so much stuff to offer. It's crazy. We could have talked for hours. So that being said, I'm going to do a very quick introduction. You can go back and check out interview 7, but we are going to be discussing with Andy Dietz today. He has a degree in mass communication, minor in music. He has traveled the world literally with a gospel quartet, written books. He has done all kinds of stuff. The guy blows me away with how much he's done. But here's the crazy part. He got kidnapped years ago and wrote a book on it, and that is what we're going to be discussing today, is Kidnapped in Budapest, his book, and also his mission trips and the things he does going to China. So Andy, are you fired up and ready to go, my friend?
You bet. And hey, I want to say congratulations on having the number one podcast. You're doing great, and it's well deserving.
Thank you, and it's so good much to— Yeah, it's been fun. I think, to be honest with you, I think my favorite part is getting to meet so many cool people, and then also getting the emails. We get a lot of emails, people saying that they found purpose or they're finding, or it's changed their lives. So that really gets me excited. And then what's really cool is when you see like them coming in from other countries. I don't know what it is about that, but it just seems cool when you get something from somebody from another country, I guess.
That's a great deal.
Okay. So, Andy, so a little bit different show, how we're going to structure this, but I want to go into your heart for missions leading up to why you do it. Let's talk a little bit why you do missions, your heart for it, and then that'll lead us into the book.
Well, you know, it really started years ago when I was a 9 or 10 year old boy in an organization called RAs, Royal Ambassadors, in our church that I grew up in Borger. A gentleman that was in his 60s took on all these little boys and put up with them, but he challenged us to memorize scripture. And the first scripture I memorized was Jesus wept, because it was the shortest one.
I like that idea.
You bet. But then the next one, I felt like, well, I probably need to be a little more challenged. So I memorized Matthew 28, 19 and 20, go ye therefore in all the world. And so that scripture stuck with me. And not long after that, I read a book by Bill Wallace called Bill Wallace in China. And just the horrific things that I read in that book about Christians being all kinds of things happening to Christians in different countries. It made me really wake up just as a young boy. And so God put that desire for missions in my heart. I never thought I'd go to China or around the world. I've been to 43 countries, and I never thought I'd leave Texas. But God has really blessed me. So that's kind of what started it all. And then God stirred that up years later as my brother and I were traveling and singing, and we got invitations to go to Mexico and places like that, and we saw what the real world was like. And then later we went on a USO tour, a Bob Hope USO tour, in fact, and we're in the Caribbean for a month. And it's just a different kind of life. And that just said, that brought that scripture back to me and what I learned as a young boy. And I had a desire just to tell people about Jesus that were not in the United States necessarily. I have a passion for those here in our states, but around the world, I wanted to do that. So that's kind of how it all started.
I want to ask you, you talk about you've been to 43 different countries. Has that really given you a different perspective of life or just an appreciation for how blessed we are here?
That was the very first thing it did, was how blessed we were here in the United States. This is the best country in the world. When you go to other countries, socialist countries and communist countries and just poor countries that are struggling, you see the people, and that's really who's hurting are the people. And you see people living in conditions that you wouldn't want to live in the United States, and people really don't live in the United States. There may be some in some parts of the country, but for the most part, it's something I'd never seen before. And so it woke me up to what the real world was.
Yeah, I bet that really was an eye-opener. So let's go into Budapest. I'm assuming that's where you were talking about your book. Had you done a previous? Was this like your first mission trip? Or how many had you done before you got on this trip?
Oh, my goodness. I'd been on many. I don't know. We'd gone to Mexico for about 15 years every year, and then I'd been just different places. I'd been to Poland, and I'd been all over Europe with another friend who owned the drama that we were doing in Budapest, actually. And he and I had made a tour across Europe just to find out the best place to do the drama. So that's why I was in Budapest, was doing a drama.
Okay. So going into there, I guess you didn't really have any fear as far as going on mission trips up to this point, I would assume, or did you?
Not really. I mean, I had seen things in the other countries and knew you need to be a little bit aware and of your surroundings, people around you. And that was even before all the terrorist stuff started. So you just know that, you know, it's not the same as the U.S. Some of the countries actually are a little more safer, I believe, even in the U.S. But so you kind of watch your back a little bit. But there wasn't a lot of fear, no. In fact, this is my fifth time to Budapest. I'd been invited actually by the president of Budapest because his son the year before had gotten saved during our drama. I didn't even know who he was. He's like a 12, 13-year-old kid, and he followed us around the whole 3 weeks we were there and didn't even tell us who he was, but he got saved. And then we were going to Russia the next year and not go back to Budapest because a lot of evangelism had started in Budapest and there was a lot of good work being done. And we couldn't get a visa to Russia. So I called the gentleman that owned the drama and I said, listen, let's don't do that in Russian because we can't get a visa. And he said, I can't believe you just called me. The president of Hungary just called me and he wants you to come back because his son got saved, led him to the Lord. And he wanted us to come do it for the parliament there in Budapest, Hungary.
Man, that's powerful. I was just thinking about that. Just sharing the gospel with a kid, his dad gets saved, but he's the president of a nation. And just right. The impact, the spiritual impact that has over a nation because of just being obedient and all coming out of a kid.
Exactly. And we had no clue who he was. We just knew he was a good kid and he followed us around everywhere we went.
Wow, that's powerful. Okay, so let's dive into the book. Why don't you lead me into the journey, things that happen, like the high part of the trip, or if there was a high part, maybe. But let's talk about like the low part, man. Let's take me on this journey of your mission trip.
Well, I had a team of 15 that went with me, and I'd sent them all home and gone to Moscow, Russia to help one of my teenagers that was in my youth group that had started a church in Nemchevka, Russia, which is a suburb of Moscow. And so I'd been there 2 weeks, and I had to come back through Budapest. And one of the down parts was we were staying in a hostel. It was really a college campus that opened up during the summer for tourists. And so we'd stayed there all 5 years we'd been there, but it was just kind of a drab place and a lot of people in it. When we were there, there was a Russian group and some others in there. But when I went back, they'd already closed it. When I came back from Russia, they'd already closed it. And they left it open just for me. So I was the only person in a three-story building alongside the one that ran it. And he was an older man, about 72 years old. So I went up there and I saw a doll in Budapest a couple weeks before when my daughter was with me on that particular mission trip. She was in the drama. And she had seen it and kind of liked it. And her birthday was coming up. So I was going to surprise her with the doll. So I said, I need to go back into town in Budapest, take the subway in down to what's called Váci út Street. It's the tourist area of Budapest. And I want to get that doll for her. By this time, I had spent most of my money that I had planned for this whole trip. I probably had maybe $100 or $200 left on me. I can't remember exact amount, but it wasn't a lot. And I had a couple credit cards. So went to get the doll. I saw it, and I said, you know, I could go down by the river, and they have like a street market on the river. I might can find this doll for the same price or even cheaper. And so I did. I found it. But I didn't want to carry it around with me everywhere. So I said, okay, I'm going to eat. I'll come back and get the doll, go back to the hotel, go to bed, because my flight out of there was 5 o'clock the next morning. So and I went into the restaurant, and it was a mafia-owned restaurant. I didn't know it at the time. I'd heard about them. I knew they were there, but didn't even think about it because in my fifth year there, and I got comfortable. As we were talking about a minute ago, I got a little bit too comfortable. And so it was a mafia-owned restaurant, and basically they surrounded me, and extortion started at that point.
Now, hold on. Were you sitting down in the restaurant eating?
Yes, I had gone, I came up to, I didn't know if it was a restaurant or not, but there was a lady in a white shirt and a black skirt, and she had a little girl sitting on a deacon's bench right there, just a little church bench right next to her on the outside, and she was behind a podium, and I said, is it a restaurant? And she goes, yes, and I said, okay, and so she took me in. It was just totally dark. I couldn't see a thing, and all I could see was her white shirt, and I stayed as close as I could to her. And she took me way back two or three turns and set me down on a bench, a table in front of me, and I was against a wall, and I couldn't see anything. And it took me probably 5 minutes for my eyes to adjust, and even at that, there wasn't a lot you could see. I could see a light on back towards what I thought was the kitchen. And she asked if I needed something to drink, and I said, yes, Coca-Cola. So she had left at this point. So that's kind of how it all started.
Man, that's creepy. That sounds like something straight out of The Godfather.
There wasn't a horse head anywhere in this story, but
yeah, thank goodness, big old horse head right on the table, right? Lunch is served. Okay, so take me there. So now you're sitting down, you ask for a Coke, you're pretty much in the black, which sounds really creepy. What now?
Well, the lady came back out, and as far as I could tell, she was the only person in the entire building. And I was beginning to get a feeling, you know, I need to drink this Coke and get out of here. And probably take it with me. And so she brought the can out and some ice, and I'd ask for ice. You have to ask in Europe for ice or you won't get it. And it's usually only one or two cubes. But anyway, she brought she poured it, and it was a beer. And I said, no, Coca-Cola. And another girl came out in a black dress, sat down right beside me. She was drinking some kind of drink. And she said, I speak English. Can I help you? And I said, yes. I said, I ordered a Coke. And she brought me a beer. It's misunderstanding. I said, listen, just bring me the check and I'll pay for it. And she said, nim. And okay. So she told the lady, and the lady walked off. And then another girl came in and sat down by me. And I said, I got to get out of here. But I got to pay for the check, so I couldn't leave. And that's how they hook you, I guess. And so they brought the check out, and it was 92,500 forint, which is about $600.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I said, Nim, I'm not paying this. No. And I don't know a lot of Hungarian. I know a little bit, but just very little. And they go, you must pay. And here comes a guy. And he has a little cap on and wearing a suit with a vest. And he's a big, strong-looking guy, kind of short, stocky. And he says, problem? And that's about the only word he knew in Hungarian, in English. And I said, yes. I said, I ordered a Coke, and I got this. And this is almost $600, $92,000. I'm not paying this. He goes, you're going to pay. And while he's talking to me, here comes another guy. And he comes out over on my left side, and this guy's on my right side. I can't get out. So I just say, okay. And I threw down about 20 bucks worth of forint. And I said, okay, I'm gone. And I stood up, and they pushed me back down. And they said, no, you're going to pay. And I said, I'm not paying that. I said, I don't have that much money with me. And they said, you have credit cards. I go, no, I don't. And I actually, I didn't have them with me at the time. I left them at the hotel or the hostel. And the girl that spoke English, she said, everyone, all Americans have credit cards. And said, we go to your hotel. They're at your hotel. You know, and so that started the whole thing. And they were going to take me to a hotel. A taxi driver came in. He had another guy with him. So now there's four guys and these two girls. And so I start thinking, you know, how can I get out of this? I said, OK, I'll give them what money I have. But when they take me outside, I'm going to run. I'm just going to run, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the obvious thing to do, not make a big problem right there while I'm in. And it's still dark and I wasn't sure where the entrance was, you know, to that place, because we'd made a couple of turns back into a room. And so as we all got up, we started towards the door and I just followed them, still fairly dark. And as we got closer to the door, I could see light. And I said, OK, I'm going to wait till I get to the door, then I'll run. Well, we got to the door and the taxi was pulled up right at the door with the door open and I couldn't get past. And there was another man standing out there. So I had to get in the taxi. That's the only choice I had. And he had pulled it up on the sidewalk there.
So what's going through your mind? Like, I'm freaking out just thinking of, like, I'm walking as if I'm walking out the door with you right now. And I'm just thinking I would be freaking out. Like, God, what in the heck am I going to do?
Yeah. You know, I've had people say, well, I would have done this or I'd have done that. And I go, yeah, until you're in that situation. And then you think differently when you think maybe your life's on the line. I didn't think my life was on the line at the time, but I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know what happened in Hungary a lot, but I knew the mafia was there. So, and that's never a good thing. So I got in the taxi, a man and a lady on my left, a man and a lady on my right, the three men in the front. And this is a little car about the size of a Volkswagen. Yeah, I'm packed in there. But I said, if this thing stops at a light, I'm going to get out some kind of way. And so I looked for the handle and everything. But they never stopped. They ran red lights and turned corners and sped through the whole town. And they'd ask me, where is your hostel? Well, I told them the area where the subway comes up. And that's all I knew. But I didn't think, I mean, it was still four or five blocks from there before they'd find my hostel. And so we went all the way there. And then finally, when we got to that place, they said, OK, where is it? You know, you got to tell us where it is. So I said, OK, it's down the street here. So we went to the hostel. Here's the 72-year-old man. By this time, it all started about 6 at night. By this time, it's probably 7:30 or 8. And the sun's going down in the summer. I mean, it's you still have about another 30 minutes or so before it goes down. And I said, I've got to do something before it gets dark. And so they pull up to the hostel and has a fence around it because they were doing construction outside. And the older man was standing there. He goes, Andy, Andy, you okay? You okay? He didn't speak much English. I said, I'm okay. 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 I said, I need my key. And so they all went in with me. He gave me my key. I went down to my room, got my credit cards. And I said, I don't know what we're going to do with these to myself, but I got them anyway. I was just looking for a way out. Not even thinking, now they know where I live. Now they know where I'm staying. You know, that really didn't cross my mind that much until I got the cards and I go, oh, they know where they know my room and everything now. So I really didn't have a choice at that point. So they took me back out. I thought the older man would probably call the police, but he didn't. And so as we're leaving, I said, I'll be okay. I'll be okay. And so they throw me back in the car and I said, okay, what are they going to do? Surely they'll take me to a bank. Is there a bank open this late at night or whatever? If there is, maybe I can get some cash. But they took me to an ATM. Now, this is in 1998, John. So back then, we didn't have the debit cards. We didn't have the PIN numbers, all that kind of stuff. Everybody just had a credit card and they used them, you know. Well, they took me to a debit machine, so I needed to have a PIN number and everything. And I had an American Express, and it wouldn't take an American Express. And then I had a Visa, but it belonged to my church. And so
wow.
I'm putting numbers in, trying to get the Visa to work, and nothing's going to work. And the gentleman that first came out with the cap and the suit on just started screaming at me. And I said, what are you saying? And he says, you're going to die. You're going to die. And I said, well, if you'll take me to a bank, I can get cash. I don't know my PIN number. He says, everyone knows their PIN number. I said, no, we don't have PIN numbers in the United States. And so they said, okay, bank, this is it. And so they threw me back in the car. took me to Vachute Street is where it all started, that area, which is the tourist area. And I knew that area well. And so they took me up to a bank, which I didn't even know was there. About three or four more guys were there as we got there.
It's like 8 o'clock at night and there's a bank open? Or is it a special bank? They have connections to open the bank.
Oh, it's a sidewalk bank. It was okay. And I went up to it and I gave my American Express and he said, "We don't take American Express." And the saying back then in 1998, American Express used everywhere or something like that. I forget what their quote was, but it wasn't used in Budapest. And so I handed them the church credit card, which was a Visa. And I felt bad about that, but, you know, I had to do something. So he ran it through and he says, "The card's no good," the teller there. And they're all standing around me. I mean, by this time, there's 10 people around me.
Wow.
And they just keep finding friends on the street as we walk and stuff. And I said, if I could make a phone call, I can get my PIN number. I can get the number I need. And they said, "Okay, one phone call, that's it." And there's this girl is interpreting all of this. And the other guys are shouting at me. I don't know what they're shouting, but she interprets. So we start walking down Vachute Street. They're all around me. I mean, just as tight as they can be. One guy had his arm in my arm just so I won't run, that kind of stuff. And they stop at a sidewalk phone. It's on a wall. And there's a guy on the phone leaning against the wall talking. And they just reach over and grab the phone out of his hand and push him down and get him out of the way. And he moves. I mean, he knows who they are, I guess. And he's not going to mess with them. And they hand me the phone. Well, you have to have a card to stick in the phone, an international card. And I didn't have one. And I said, I don't have a card. And so the guy with the hat said, "I've got one." And he put it in there. And he said, "Okay, make a phone call." And I just happened to know what the international number was, 001 for the United States. And I'd trained my whole team. If you have to make a call, emergency call, you need to know it's 001 before you can call the United States. So I called that, hoping it'd work. And Becky answers the phone, my wife. And, "Well, what are you doing calling?" And we never call each other when we're out of the country. She went to Poland one time without me, and she didn't call, and I never called. We just would send emails or something, but never call very often. And she was really surprised. I said, "Well, I'm okay, but," I said, "I've got a little problem." She goes, "Well, what's that?" And I said, "I've been kidnapped." And I started talking real soft. I leaned up against the wall there on the outside. And I said, "But it's okay. They're wanting some money." I said, "I need the PIN number to the church credit card." She goes, "I don't know that." She says, and "I don't have a phone. I'll have to run to the neighbor and call the church." I said, "Okay, well, you need to do it pretty quickly." And she goes, "Okay." So she did. And about 5 minutes later, she came back. These people are getting agitated. And she comes back. She says, "Dixie doesn't know the PIN number."
Oh, my gosh.
I said, "Okay. Well, see if you can get it and see if you can find a Western Union. And I'll try to call you back. I'll tell them I have a number." She goes, "Okay." So I hung up the phone. I said, "Okay, let's go back to the bank."
And so Andy, let me ask you this. Do they have like a certain amount in mind? I mean, I know that your bill came out and it was like $600 for your wannabe Coke. But, I mean, was there a certain amount that they were trying to get, or was it just whatever they could get?
Well, it was $600 is what they wanted. But and I later understood, I have my own FBI agent now that about every 3 years comes by and says we still hadn't solved this case. But I had to have an FBI agent because it was a federal thing that happened. So he said, he told me that the second time I saw him, he said, "What we found out was if you get over $600, then it becomes a bigger offense." And so they wanted to stop right about $600. Excuse me.
Okay.
So, but I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know how much they were going to get or what they were going to want to get. And they'd already said they're going to, I was going to die. So, so we went back to the bank. I gave him the card again and he said, no. I said, "Try it." He said, "It didn't work." I said, "Well, I have this other card. If I can get the number, if I can make one more phone call." They said, "One more phone call. This is it." And I mean, just screaming at me. And then crowds are looking at me and more people are joining the group. And so they took me to a phone booth, four or five blocks away in a darker area of Budapest, of the downtown area. And they put me in the phone booth and I made the phone call. And I said, "Okay, Becky," I said, "did you find a Western Union?" She goes, "Yes. There's one Western Union in Hungary, in Budapest." And that's a city of, you know, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 million people. And she said, there's one there, but it closed at 6 o'clock.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, okay. I said, I'll try to find it. I don't know what to do. I said, did you get a PIN number? She goes, no. I said, okay. I said, well, I'm going to try to escape. I think I can. And she'd been to Budapest before, so she knew what it was like. I said, there's a Burger King across from the bank. I'm going to try to get in there if I can somehow. So we go back to the bank again, thinking I have my number, and I don't. And across the teller's head, it says Western Union, the fastest way to send money. Now, what are the chances of that?
Yeah.
100%. If you're a faithful servant to God and he's in charge, well, he's going to open some doors. And so I asked the teller there that spoke English, and people are just standing around me totally. And I said, is the Western Union open? He goes, Egan, yes. Yes, it's open. I said, okay, I need to form so I can fill out and get some money. Okay. While I'm standing there, there's a gentleman to my right, and he has a British accent. He's on the other side of 2 or 3 people, and his window's right next to mine. I said, sir, I said, where are you from? He said, I'm from the UK. I said, can you help me? And these guys don't speak English. My interpreter was back behind me. And he said, what's the problem? I said, I've been kidnapped. He goes, he just looked at me. He says, no, I can't. And he walked off.
And so, oh, my gosh, dude, that is terrible.
So I thought, oh, no, this is not good. And so they gave me the form. I filled it out. And at the bottom, it said control number. Well, when you use Western Union, which I had never used before at that point, you have to have a control number. And so I asked the banker, I says, what's the control number? He says, you have to have a number from the people you're getting the money from, which basically back in the U.S., if my wife or whatever. And I said, well, can you send it through? He said, okay. So he sent it through. It came back denied. The guy in the cap and everything was ticked off. He was mad. He's pounding on the counter there in front of the bank. It's an outdoor bank, and there's a counter. And he's just pounding on it, and all the people around him are just, I'm sure, cussing. I don't know what they're doing, but it was a bad scene. He said, you die, you die. I said, the girl came up to me. She goes, I said, what did he say? He says, you die. And I said, listen, and I grabbed her hair and I put her head down by the little opening in the window. And I said, if I get the control number, will you give me the money? And he said, yes. I said, tell her. And he told her. And so she said, okay, one more phone call. So this time, and there were some more phone calls in between, but I'll make it short. We started down Vachute Street and turned right towards the river, and it starts getting dark. There's no light that way. There's not a lot of people that way. In fact, the street we were walking down was totally empty, except for about the 15 or so people and myself. They were surrounding me. And I looked down towards the river, which was probably about 3 blocks off. I saw a white shirt. And it was a man coming towards me, and he had muscles just bulging out under that T-shirt that he had on, a white T-shirt. And he had a ponytail. I could see his ponytail through there was kind of some moonlight behind him. And just, he's probably 6'2", something like that. I said, this is the guy that's going to kill me. This is him.
Oh, gosh.
And, it starts going through my mind. They're going to throw me in the Yangtze. I mean, not the Yangtze. That's China. They're going to throw me in the Danube River, which is the river that's right there by. And I said, I just had all these things going through my mind. And so they start yelling at him down, and he gets closer. And as they get closer, he points to his right. And so I look to my left, and there's a phone booth there. And there's a little light in it. And that's the only light in that whole street. And you can just barely see anything except for the moonlight. So they put me in that phone booth, and Becky gets me a number. They take me back. This guy joins us. They take me back down to Vachute Street to the bank. And I fill out the form, and I ask for $600, and he sends the form through, and they send back $450.
Mm.
That's all they will do. And so I give them the money, and I mean, it's in fourth, and it's a stack of probably 3 or 4 feet high. I mean, it's a lot of money in fourth.
I wanted to ask you that. So 400, I mean, I'm thinking in my mind, gosh, that's not a whole lot of money, whatever. But to them, was that a lot of money at that time there? Or
Hungary it was. I mean, Hungary's fairly a good place. I mean, they make money, and it's not a poor country by any means, but it's not like the United States. But that is a good salary for somebody, or $600.
Okay.
But I think it's all they could get. They would have gotten more if they didn't want it to become a federal offense, which it did later because I got more than that. But So that it was very interesting. But so they gave me the money. We sit down on this little bench right in front of the bank, and I counted out to him, which takes a little while. And I mean, it's 28-1 or something. I don't know what it is, the exchange rate. But so I counted to him. They said, okay, we want $100 more. And I said, well, I'll have to make another phone call, get another number. So they took me back to the sidewalk phone where they pushed the guy off the phone. There was another person on that. They pushed that person off and gave me the phone. And I told Becky, I need another bit of money. This is kind of interesting. And this happened with the first amount of money. When I called home, by this time, there's 70, 80 people in my home in Borger. And they're making phone calls. Their senators were called. The FBI had been called, several people. And I found out that day that there were two embassies in Africa that had been bombed. And this was like our very first really terrorist attack that had happened in the world was this day.
So they're kind of correlating possibly. They don't know whether this has something to do with that, I'm assuming.
Well, that wasn't what the conversation was. The conversation was the embassy cannot help you because they are shut down. So they cannot come out and help you, but the police know. Well, I had been walking back towards the bank at one point, and there was a policeman there, and Becky had told me the police knew, and I saw him off at a distance, maybe, you know, half a block away, and he caught my eye, and I caught his eye, and I just mouthed to him, help me, my eyes wide open. And these guys around me didn't see that, but he saw me, and he shook his head no and turned and walked away. So I knew, okay, the police aren't going to help me, the citizens aren't going to help me. And I don't even know if the police are in on it or not. So I start all these things going through my mind. So we come back for the next amount, but there was a gentleman in my house in Borger, and I was trying to get the money to begin with the first time, and the Western Union wouldn't give my wife the money. She said, no, you have to come down here. Well, there was a guy in there named Michael, and Michael, my wife and I had canceled. He and his wife, they were on the verge of divorce. He was doing drugs. His life was messed up. She had actually filed for divorce. But Becky and I started counseling them, and God started changing their life. And he was in there, and he talks like a Texan. He goes, give me the phone. He said, listen. And he's talking to the guy, the lady at the Western Union. He said, give the man the money. He said, you're going to be good for it. And this was his personal secretary that ran the Western Union. So what are the chances of that? 100%. So he said, give the man the money. I'll be good for it. So that's how I got the money to begin with. She wouldn't do it unless we came down and paid for it. But since she was his secretary, she would. So on the second time, I said, just give me $100 and I'm going to keep this and I'm going to try to escape. I told Becky that. So just have the group praying for me. And so we went back to the bank and asked for $100. Came back, they were going to give me $100 in foreign. I said, give it to me in U.S. And the girl standing next to me, the interpreter, said, no, foreign. I said, it's too much money. It takes too long to count. Give me. She goes, okay. And so I talked her into it. They gave me $100. So we went back to the bench with just two or three steps. They're all surrounding me, and I'm going to sit down. Well, instead of sitting down, I just busted through. And I went into a Burger King right across the way. And so at that point, that's where this whole story changes. So it ends.
Wow, man, that's intense.
Yeah. And I went up in the, I went in the Burger King, and one guy came in, the original guy in the cap and everything came in, and I told him, no, I'm not doing this. And so they all stood outside. There was only one way in and one way out of that Burger King, unless you went through the kitchen. And I'd been in that Burger King many times, and there's an upstairs too. But so I was sitting in the middle, and here's tourists in there. And so I said, what am I going to do? So I go back to the counter and I said, do you have telephone? And right on a post right to my left was a telephone facing the counter. Well, the guys outside the mafia couldn't see that phone. Now, I don't know if they knew it was in there or not. So I just kind of get behind the pole and I said, does anybody speak English here? They're all waiting outside for me to come out. They knew I had to come out. And a girl behind the counter said, I speak English. And I said, can you call the police? So she called the police. She hung up. She said, okay, you have to go to the police station. I said, no. I said, the police need to come here. So she called again, and she called the police. And in about 5 minutes, a little car came up on the sidewalk, and three policemen walked in, and the mafia scattered. So that I was at that point. That's where I thought maybe I was safe, but I really wasn't yet. So it went on from there.
Wow. So I don't want to give away the whole book, obviously, because I want the readers to go on Amazon or whatever, buy the book, and read it. But at least how much longer does this go from Burger King to finally getting home?
Well, that was around 11 o'clock at night. I didn't know if I could even get a taxi back home. Everything's going to start shutting down. I knew I had to do something, so I burst through the group and went into the Burger King. But it went on till the next morning, till I caught my international flight out of there. There were people following me and stuff like that. And so the taxi driver that picked me up, who the embassy had sent, was suspicious about some people. So it went on from there until I got into Amsterdam. There was a person on the airplane with me. So, and I escaped that as well, too. But it's, anyway, there's several other things that happened along the way.
Yeah, we don't want to give away all the details, man, for sure.
Ending over. But obviously, I made it out, but it was still pretty intense.
So I'm just curious, how long after that, I mean, that had to shake you up, I would think, pretty good. I mean, obviously we have faith, and I see all that God's hand through this whole deal. But no matter what, at least maybe for me, I would think it would shake me up for a while before I went on another mission trip.
Actually, I just blamed myself because 5 years before when we first went to Budapest, we were told, you know, be careful what restaurant you go in. Go into Western restaurants or ones that your people take you in that they know where you're supposed to go. And so I kind of blamed myself for it, not thinking that it would ever happen to anyone unless they did walk into those situations by themselves, which normally you're not by yourself on that time I was. But I'll be honest with you, I really couldn't pray at the time because my mind's just going, okay, what do I do next? I need to be careful what I do here, or they're going to get mad, or I need to be careful with this, or, you know, that, or is my timing right, or is it not right? Those things are going through your mind. And I'm praying, yes, but you're just overwhelmed with all the situation itself. There's a passage in Psalms 121, verse 7, it says, the Lord will protect you from all evil. He will keep your soul. The Lord will guard your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forever. And that scripture kind of stayed on my mind while I was there, that God's going to protect me. I mean, the Western Union in itself was 100% God.
Yeah.
The ability to be able to make a phone call was 100% God. It's just, there were several things that happened that I knew God was opening doors. So, yes, I was afraid, but I would have gone back the next week, honestly. I would have gone back to Budapest the next week after it was over. I was scared, no doubt. When they tell you you're going to die, you start thinking about how you're going to die. And then that night, the police actually took me back to my hotel. Well, they knew where I was. They were going to put me in another hotel, and I didn't even want to go to the trouble doing all that. And I didn't know if they were going to charge me or not, but the embassy, I found out later, was going to take care of it. And there were two men out behind my hotel sitting in a car waiting for me to get in, and they didn't even see me come in. The lights weren't on, and I didn't turn them on, and I saw them sitting out there. So that was kind of how the story went from there till the next morning, even onto the airplane. So
I want to ask you this, Andy. So you probably the first time in your life where maybe you were in a situation you thought, I'm going to die, right? It's pretty intense. I'm just curious. This is going through my mind. And for our listeners, if anyone else is wondering, did the question like, I would have done something different with my life, or I would have done this or this, knowing like I could die today, I would have changed this. Like, did you have any of those thoughts or even afterwards thinking like going forward with the rest of your life?
Well, you know, my life from the time I was in high school, I have a twin brother. We traveled and sang with quartets, and then we traveled as a duet and we did a lot. I think I did a whole lot more. I lived all out. And you know, I have a saying even on my Skype here, live your life to the fullest. You know, don't hold back. And so I'd lived that kind of life. There really wasn't anything else I think I would have done other than, you know, I told my family goodbye, but I didn't have that opportunity because by that time my kids were grown and most of them were out of the house except for two. But no, I didn't. Other than, you know, I wouldn't make that mistake again. I'd remember that there are restaurants that are not good. But one thing I did learn from the whole story was that as I was on the airplane about to land in Dallas, coming back from New York, we came from Amsterdam to New York, and I'm on the airplane, and we're about to land in Dallas. I said, God, I'd ask him this, you know, the first plane I got on in Amsterdam. Lord, why did this happen to me? I want you to show me, what is the purpose in this? There's a purpose in everything that happens. And I know the purpose of my life, but what is the purpose of this event? And he said, as desperate as you were to live, I want you to be that desperate to know me. Mm. So
take me there. We're getting a little on time and I want to wrap it up a little bit, yeah. But take me to that, because that changed. I'm assuming that really changed your walk with the Lord.
It really did. I felt like at that time, and most people would think, well, I've got a pretty good walk with the Lord. I mean, especially if you're a minister, and I was a minister, a youth minister and missions pastor at the time. But when I really surveyed my whole life, I said, no, it's been more about me than it's been about God. And I want to learn how to hear God more than I've ever heard God before. And, you know, the Bible says, my sheep hear my voice and they know me. I mean, I could rattle off 50 scriptures. But I said, I want to learn how to hear him. I want to make sure that everything I'm doing is what he wants me to do, and I'm fulfilling his purpose, not my purpose. And God revealed to me later that my purpose was to be the voice of truth for God. And so everything I do, I want to speak truth. And so God just intensified that in my life. And after that point, we started going to Asia. In fact, I just got back 2 weeks ago from Asia and been going there 20 years and seeing God do a great work over there. And I got more intense about, okay, God, where do you want me to be and what do you want me to do? Every day is really saying, okay, God, my life is your life. What do you want me to do? And I want to hear you. And so that's how it intensified. And I've gotten deeper with the Lord than I've ever been in my life. I feel like best friends. And I hope every person listening, if you're just a casual Christian, will get to the point in your life where God has a plan for you. Every person that's born, God has a purpose and a plan. And if they'll start seeking him like they're about to die, like they value their life, if they'll value their relationship with the Lord like they value their life, he'll change their life. If every Christian would do that, this world would be evangelized years ago. And people trust. And I got intense, more so than I'd ever been in my life.
So how did that change your spiritual walk intensified? What did that look like? I think everything starts spiritually before it manifests into the physical. And what did that look like in your physical life, though? Like, as you started intensifying your walk with the Lord, how did that change your physical life, like the outward appearance, what people saw?
Well, the first thing Becky said when I got home was, your hair is grayer. And I think this whole experience, my hair turned grayer. But they just saw that I was serious about my walk with the Lord. I'm a cut up guy and I love to have fun and everything. But at the same time, they saw that everything I did, I wanted to make sure I was doing what the Lord would do. In fact, the Lord started speaking to me a couple of years later, that, okay, you've been comfortable where you've been in Borger. I'd been in some large churches. I'd been in Oklahoma, a church of 3,000. I had 700 in my youth group. I'd been in a church in Amarillo. Then I went to Borger and was there 27 years. And I said, I'm in a comfort zone. And people go, you're not in a comfort zone. You travel the world. And I go, no, I'm in a comfort zone. And that's why I'm where I'm at now in Groom, Texas, a little town of 600 people. Because I wanted to get out of my comfort zone. I said, okay, God, my life is yours. My yes is on the altar. What do you want to do with me? And he said, I want you to get out of your comfort zone. Because mission trips was a comfort zone for me. I mean, it wasn't, even after being kidnapped. But coming to a little town, a cowboy town, a ranch town, a farm town, it was out of my comfort zone. And God has really used us here. And it's been an eye-opening experience to see another part of the world, the little town part of the world of America. and the need for God, even in a small town like this. So it started changing how I read the Bible. It started changing how I studied the Bible. It started changing my priorities. I started saying, okay, this is the specific times I'm going to start listening to God, and I'm going to not let anybody disturb me. But at this time in the morning, I'm having a quiet time every day, no matter what. You know, and I started organizing a little bit more so that God had priority in my life. And I guess physically people saw that in me as being more intense spiritually.
That's awesome, man. I appreciate that. Man, Andy, I love your story. It's awesome. Thank you for just coming on the show, and I've had the pleasure of getting to know you over the last several years because of Matt. As we close up, I hope some of our listeners would reach out to you, invite you to their churches, and get your book. How do we find you and get your book and come have you teach or preach at our church?
Okay. I have a website, Andy Dietz, and Dietz is spelled diet with a Z on the end of it, D-I-E-T-Z, and andydietz.net is my website. They can contact me at kidnap98@gmail.com, kidnap98@gmail.com if they want, and just send me an email. I'll be glad to reach them. The book you can get on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever. You can order the book off my website as well, too, if they want to do that. Sometimes people want them signed, so I'll do that if they want to do that.
Yes, so for our listeners, please go on Andy's website, get a signed copy directly from Andy, and that would be awesome. Andy, as we wrap up the show right now, what piece of advice going through, you've been all over the world, you've sang, you've done so many different things. What is one piece of parting advice that you would give our listeners?
I think the most important thing I could say is know that everyone has a specific purpose that God has for them. And you need to find out what that purpose is. And if you don't know, I'll be glad to tell you. I teach a purpose course. There's LLBD teaches a purpose course. There's a lot of people that teaches how you can find your purpose. But the most important thing, even if you can't get with somebody that can guide you through that, man, God wants to tell you something. God, you can hear God, and if you'll learn to listen to God, God's going to open up those doors and point you where you want to go. Most people get focused on their job, whether they're a farmer or a pharmacist or a doctor or a worker or a laborer or whatever, and that's not where God wants our focus. That's just an opportunity to provide for us. God wants us to focus on what His purpose is for us. And it may include your job, but what are you passionate about? What is it you're really, really passionate about? And ask God to use your passion to change people's lives and find out what your purpose is. That'd be my biggest stress that I could stress in people's life. Find your purpose.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about that. Everything that we look at on the earth, trees, oxygen, we can't see it, but everything provides something specific. It was designed specifically to do something. Exactly. And the thing is we are not any different. And, you know, it's funny you said that, Andy. I was thinking about this yesterday, actually. So I think there's like almost, 6 or 7 billion people on the planet. Is that right?
I don't know, but
it's something insane, right? So there's a lot of people. And I was actually thinking about this yesterday. There is more of an image of God on this earth today than ever in history. And I mean that by this. We're all created in the image of God. Now, obviously, mm-hmm. some people are evil. They don't live out their purpose. But for the most part, there is something inside of every one of us that bears the image of God. And I was thinking about the creativity and the artisticness of people and singing and all those things. There's more God on this earth than ever before for people to see and to appreciate.
There is. Can I make a shameless plug?
Yeah, for sure.
My youngest son, Zach, and my oldest son, Matthew, just wrote a song. It's called The Hand of God. You can get it on iTunes and stuff by Matt and Zach Dietz. But it talks exactly about that. You can see God in the air you breathe. You can see God in the creation around you. Everything around you, you can see God. How people miss Him, I don't know. But He's everywhere. And that song just is a perfect example of that. So.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Andy, hold on just a second as we wrap up. Roar Nation, I hope you enjoyed that. That was an incredible story, something a little bit different that we normally do. Wanted Andy to share his stories with you of Budapest and missions and going all over the world. So please check it out. And if you would, please rate and review us on iTunes, share it, get the message out. And again, I've been saying this, but we're about to release a book on finding your purpose and remodeling your life here shortly, probably in the next month or two. So please get on our email list. We'll be sending that out. Thank you guys so much. We love you. And just remember, at the end of the day, be real, be authentic, and be you. God bless. Cool, Andy. Man, that was good, dude.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it.
I really, really enjoyed that. I hope you get it. We just started. We get a lot more, obviously, emails now, so it's kind of cool. We'll get people that will find us, and they're like, oh, man, we listened to every episode in the last 2 weeks or something like that. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. So
that's great. Well, you know, I think there's about 300 countries that my book has been in that people have bought it that I've got.
Wow.
So it's amazing. A podcast, a book, what they can do, you know, how God can use them to reach people. So,
you know, what's funny is I feel like, you know, I'm living out my purpose doing this podcast. And what was funny is years ago, I was asking the Lord, you know, what's my purpose? What am I supposed to do? And the Lord would never tell me. He said, because you would chase after it. You would just pursue that, not the relationship, but the
right.
What my purpose. And it was funny is when I started stepping into this, the Lord revealed to me, he said, I couldn't even have told you what you were called to do because you wouldn't even understood it, because podcasting and all those things, they didn't even exist when I was asking the Lord,
right,
what was I supposed to do? Which is like, that's just funny to even think about. Like all yeah. The stuff that's happened over the years, I couldn't even have done what I was, you know, part of my journey of what the Lord was called to do. I couldn't even have done it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And what are the chances of that? 100%.
Yeah, 100%, man.
Yeah.
So,
pure
so.
Servant. So
awesome, brother.
Well, hey, I enjoy it. I appreciate you giving me this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'll be in touch, and your show will be out next Wednesday.
Okay. We'll awesome. Talk about China sometime if you want to.
Yeah, I'd love to, man. There's always stuff to talk about. We might talk about purpose.
I got some great stories about China. But, yeah.
Cool, man.
Well, yeah, I enjoy your podcasts. I listen to them. So.
Well, thank you.
They're great.
Hey, Andy, I was going to tell you, if you wanted to contribute, I know you write, I think, and or maybe you like to write, but if you wanted to start doing a blog or anything or like something exclusive, we have a blog part on our website that I'm not a writer. I'm going to do vlogs and just shoot some videos eventually. But if you would like to write about some of your stories and some of your stuff, like short articles, I would be happy to post them to promote you and your book if you want to put them on our website.
That'd be awesome. I don't know if you know, but Becky has a blog too.
Okay.
To pastor's wives. I don't know if she'd want that. She does it more exclusively for pastor's wives, but that might be something. But I do write different things. In fact, I've written another book I'm waiting to get published, Truth, the Pathway to Life,
nice.
Finding Your Purpose. So that one I'm probably going to publish on Amazon.
Well, so. The invitation's out to both you and Becky. If you guys want to post anything or do some stuff, I'd be happy to do it.
I appreciate that. I write an article every week for the bulletin that is basically life experiences, so I may do some of that.
Awesome. All
so
right,
where do I need to post that?
You would just send it to me and with a picture, and I'll have to have one either myself or somebody. We can post it up inside of our website.
Okay, so JohnBFuller@gmail.com.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right.
Awesome, man. You be blessed, and thank you so much.
Talking to you.
You too. Bye.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.